I don't belong here. It's a thought I've had more and more in recent times. My name is Bowden Nicholson, Bo for short. I was born in Townsville, Australia in the late 80s, before moving to Brisbane, Australia when I was 6 with my family. I'm white. My ancestors were too. In fact, there is no trace of anything other than white people as far back in my family tree as I've cared to look. And I don't belong here. The worst people you've ever met will try and make the claim that because I was born here, I'm somehow indigenous to the land, but they're wrong. They are idiots, and they don't really know what indigenous means. Australia before it was Australia was a collection of hundreds of different nations, all consisting of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people, the oldest continuous living culture of humans on Earth. In this sense, in the true sense, Australia has a rich and varied history, one that is largely ignored by the history books. In fact, my public school education in the 90s and 2000s was insultingly lacking in any pre-colonial history of my country, except maybe some Dreamtime stories that have survived. I don't belong here. My last name is Nicholson. That's English and Scottish. It means son of Nicholas. It's the whitest thing ever. My mother's maiden name indicates I've got some Welsh in me, for some added variety, and my grandmother's name might be why I'm so drawn to German as a language. My ancestors came over to colonise Australia, not on the first wave of ships, but in subsequent decades, and yet I don't belong here. Now don't get me wrong, immigration isn't to say that a person doesn't belong somewhere, just to be clear. That's the tool of the racist far right. Multiculturalism is a great thing that many societies around the world have. It's a strength. But I think it's important that your ancestors don't, I don't know, genocide the local population and then force the survivors of that population into a civilization they have no familiarity with. I'm not sure if my ancestors ever participated in a genocide, but I know they certainly enjoyed the benefits of colonialization, because I have. It continues to this day. Unequal access to education, to jobs, to housing, to food, and other necessities are all a symptom of continued benefits to the colonizers. I don't belong here, and I need to reframe what I said earlier. I was born on the land of the Bindal people, and so were my parents. The apartment where I live is on the land of the Turrbal and Yuggera peoples. I'm typing these words on Gubbi Gubbi country. I am both proud of the land where I live and disgusted by many of the modern day occupants of it. It's something that is very on my mind, how the predominantly English way of life has taken over in this land. Not just the language, but the food, the clothes, the customs. In 1975's Picnic at Hanging Rock, all of these ideas come to a head, where the British have imposed themselves on pre-Federation Australia, and the land is an unforgiving place for people who don't want to treat it with the respect it deserves. It's a film that posits that colonialism isn't just fundamentally wrong, but it's also dangerous. Once again, I'm Bo Nicholson, and this is Movieversaries. Yes, this is Movieversaries. I'm Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing Picnic at Hanging Rock, a candidate for greatest Australian movie ever, ! On its 50th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, if he ever went missing, I'd be beside myself and may even make a shrine in his honour. You may consider that a warning or a compliment. Anyway, it's Ian Buckley. Hello, Ian.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Do you find the threat of a shrine a compliment or a warning?
I think it's a compliment. I would love to see your shrine one day, even though I guess I'd have to disappear to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you can disappear over here to Australia. I do sense that one of my best selling points for getting you to come to Australia for a visit, apart from my presence, of course, would be to tour a place like Hanging Rock in Victoria. I imagine that'd be a bit of a draw for you.
That would be cool. Definitely the opposite side of Australia for you, though. You are a northeastern man, right?
Yes. Yes. It'd be a solid, like, day of driving, literally.
Right.
Like about 20 right. hours yeah. To get there. Yeah. So my suggestion would be we would fly to Melbourne.
That makes sense.
And that's about a 2-hour flight. And then from there, we'd get a car or something. But I reckon we could make that work. Let's talk about the film. On Valentine's Day in 1900, a group of schoolgirls and some of their college staff head out to Hanging Rock, an incredible natural landscape in Victoria, Australia. The girls are warned not to climb the rock, but four girls, led by the ethereal Miranda, ignore that advice and set off. After some exploring, three of the girls appear to enter a trance and head further up the hill, while the fourth sees something terrible, what she describes as a big red cloud, and runs screaming down the mountain to alert the rest of the group, which is already missing one teacher who appears to have headed up the mountain as well. The three girls and their teacher are missing, presumed dead. Police investigations return no clues. Eyewitnesses only saw the early ascent, not the disappearance. Directed by Peter Weir, which I've typed as weird accidentally there, and adapted from Joan Lindsay's 1967 book, the film premiered in 1975 at the Hindley Cinema Complex in Adelaide, South Australia, which sadly is now demolished. The film went on to be a success in Australia and subsequently abroad, and propelled the Australian New Wave further into the limelight. Peter Weir himself would go on to direct more successful features during the New Wave before heading to America to make films like Dead Poets Society, The Truman Show, and Master and Commander. It has an IMDb rating of 7.4 out of 10, a Metascore of 81 out of 100, and it won a BAFTA for Best Cinematography for Russell Boyd. It was nominated for several awards at the Australian Film Institute, but interestingly won zero, with Fred Schipisi's The Devil's Playground dominating many categories that year. I think it won 6 AFIs that year. Schipisi himself would go on to make The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith to etch his name among Australia's finest ever directors as well. This has a sidebar. But what I'd love to know, Ian, is what this film means to you, because for me, I think I watched it at school. And I want to say I found it pretty boring back then. I was less cultured. So I never really reached for this one. So this is my first time watching as an adult. But Ian, you were really pushing for this one. We're recording on the 5th of December in your part of the world. And this was a non-negotiable for you this year. So I want to know why.
Yeah, unfortunately, we were hoping to have our full host of hosts, but circumstances didn't allow for it. I was really curious to see what Violet was going to make of this movie. I hope we do get to hear from her at some point. I'd love to get her perspective. This one was a longtime blind spot for me. It was one of those that I certainly knew kind of by reputation. I knew that it existed as this seminal piece of Australian filmmaking, its place in the Australian New Wave, all of this sort of stuff about its kind of place in the pantheon of international film. But I still didn't really know much about it. I'd seen a couple of still images. It looked like not to be reductive, it just looked like a period drama to me, you know, not always the genre that is getting me like excited to get out and, you know, play in their waters. I see a lot of period dramas that are very effective and affecting. And I don't know why I have like a little bit of a bias against the genre. It just wasn't something that excited me. And so I just never really got around to it. But then Second Sight came out with, and this is your my plug for my collector's commentary podcast, but a company called Second Sight came out with a brand new pristine 4K remaster on disc a couple of years back, and I got it and was like, all right, I've got the house to myself. I'm going to watch this movie. I'm going to catch up with it. And I was mesmerized. I just kind of fell in love with it. I got hypnotized by it. It had the effect on me that I think it has, but, you know, at least by reputation, on a lot of people, where there's just something about it. There's many somethings about it that just kind of drew me in, made me curious, kind of made me lean into it rather than finding it sort of dry or boring. I just found it entrancing. And so I immediately after watching it, you know, it's of course got a ton of special features on the disc. So I'm watching all the interviews with Peter Weir and with all the actors, and there's some archival documentary footage. And of course there's like a commentary of the Film Scholars, which I started playing. And I just really got into this movie. And I got a chance to see it for the anniversary on the big screen earlier this year. And again, just sort of let it wash over me in a theater, and was again just swept away by it. And so, yeah, there's just some tantalizing quality to this film and this filmmaking that has drawn people to it since it came out, and certainly drew me into it as well. And yeah, it's also oddly, even though it's unsettling and sad, it's also a movie that I find a little cozy. I can sort of sink into it and sort of sink into the world and the atmosphere that it's evoking, and bathe in the waters of Picnic at Hanging Rock for a while and just sort of lose myself in it and not get bored of it at all. So yeah, I just, something about this film works for me. I'm on its wavelength, and I come away from it each time I watch it with some more questions and also thinking that I have some more answers. And yeah, I hope you liked it. I don't know what you thought of it. I always resist asking you until we have these conversations. I hope at least you didn't find it a difficult watch.
Yeah, I certainly found it a bit stuffy when I was younger. And I guess I kind of worked out why now that I'm older, is that the whole premise of the movie, as far as it's understood, is it's like, is it a true story? Is it fictional? Is it, it's this mystery of what happened to these girls, you know? So the whole thing is girls go missing. That's the main thing, right? And that happens, I want to say half an hour into the movie, maybe 35 minutes into the movie, when the four women and girls go missing. So up until that point, it's quite propulsive, right? Like the music with the pan flute and these ethereal images, and you have, like, you know, that girl that's, I think it's Irma, who's dancing on top of the rock, and it's like that shot from underneath her with sort of pointed towards the sun in the background. Great shot. Like a lot of this is really great stuff. It's really building nicely. There's like an undertone from the music. I want to say music done by Bruce Smeaton. Yes, Bruce Smeaton. So he does the additional music apart from the pan flute and the use of Beethoven. So there's like an undercurrent building there, and I'm like, oh, this is very tense. And then the disappearance happens, and then there's like a period of the film where it's like, okay, we're gonna try and find these girls. So like the boys go and do that, and the main character becomes the headmistress. It's sort of revealed that the main character is the headmistress, and then it's sort of revealed that the main point of this story probably is not the girls going missing. So I think watching it again as an adult, I recognized that, and then I went, oh, I'm watching a different movie. Like I don't think I'm really watching a movie about girls going missing. It is obviously somewhat about that, but it's more about this, the themes of the thing, which we'll get into, but just this headmistress and her descent into madness and villainy, really. Probably outright villainy in some ways, depending on your interpretation of the film. It's not a mystery to be solved, very deliberately. I guess I found that difficult-ish on the first watch again. So I watched it again basically immediately, much more on the wavelength the second time, once I knew what I was getting into. Once I knew that it was like, okay, don't fight the headmistress becoming the main character, go with it. And try and work out what it's trying to say. And I found that a lot more interesting and a lot more rewarding. So to answer your question in the long-winded way that I do, yes, I did like it. You can be safe in saying
that. I'm very glad. Yeah, I'm very glad to hear that. And you're right. It is something that I think people do bounce off of, especially on first viewing sometimes, because it presents itself as being a bit more of an actual mystery movie. And while it is mysterious and it has deeper, mysteries in terms of the great issues and themes of the world and being a human in it, it isn't actually, like you said, about the actual quote unquote true crime. We'll get into the actual truth of the movie a little bit later, but it's not a true crime story. This isn't like a mystery, this isn't a Knives Out mystery. There isn't going to be a reveal at the end. Things will be revealed, but that sort of initial mystery that kicks off the narrative, that thing is not really ultimately the point. It's really about how that event impacts all the other parties sort of surrounding it and the things that it reveals about the people involved and maybe perhaps about the culture involved and the land involved. We'll get into all that, but this is clearly a movie that has more than the simple disappearance of these girls in mind. And we should say that this is based on an Australian novel that came out about a decade earlier that was a bit of a sensation in Australia. And the very idea of adapting a novel to film was itself a novel idea in the Australian film industry at the time. It just generally wasn't something that was done. It was sort of considered the purview of, the Americans, the British, whomever, not something that was commonly done in Australia. And, Peter Weir and others were really taken by this novel and taken by the mystery at its core, but also by the sense that it was somehow about something more, something else. The author of this book, Joan Lindsay, the folks who interacted with her while they were making the film, she actually visited the set. And Peter Weir in the pre-production process interacted with her quite a bit. They all came away from interactions with her with the sense that there was some kernel of truth or trauma or both at the heart of this story, even though no one could really find any information about an event that matched this exact story. There were some like local legends about three girls who went missing back in like the 1860s. There was that there were always things going on too that went unreported in the press, but there seemed to be some kernel of truth or experience in the author's past that informed a lot of the kind of themes that are bubbling up under the surface of this film. And the filmmakers wanted to preserve that sense in the movie itself. Like, you get characters who speak in certain ways and speak about certain things in a way that feels, not necessarily like naturalistic or realistic, but that is getting at this general sense of something is wrong in the world. Something is wrong about our presence on this land. Something is wrong about the society in which we are finding ourselves. And yeah, it's got a lot going on under the surface and is also just gorgeous and sounds fantastic. It's a pretty incredible piece of work, especially from, we talk about young filmmakers, emerging filmmakers. This was like Peter Weir's second or third movie, certainly his biggest, to that point.
Yeah, and he, as I said before, he goes on to have an amazing career. I want to pick up on what you talked about with that surrealist kind of method in the dialogue, because I think that was one thing that I found off-putting initially, was the performances of some of the girls is a bit off-putting. I particularly talk about Edith, who's the hysterical one that runs down the mountain. A lot of the speaking is done in post-production, sometimes even by completely different actors, which is just this weird disconnect. And I don't know, in a way, that was like a shortcoming for me, but in a way, it kind of adds to this like weird, ethereal kind of dreamlike, mystical thing the film has going on. And then they have these like 15-year-old girls. And I admit that 1900 is a different time and maybe the language was more proper, but I can't think of many 15-year-old girls that would say things like, quote, "A surprising number of human beings are without purpose, though it is probable that they are performing some function unknown to themselves." Like 15-year-olds don't talk like that. So it's about attaining this kind of like, no, we're not shooting for realism here. We're shooting for mystical, dreamlike, ethereal is the word I keep coming back to in my mind.
And those girls who go up, like that quote is from one of the three girls who goes missing, I think, crucially. Yes. I think that one of the things at play kind of under the surface here is the sense that we're meant to get that something is a little bit different about these girls, certainly the two who never come back and the teacher. And you get these little glimpses in this opening of how each of them is just a little bit off of maybe what you would expect from them. The teacher that's one of the chaperones that's in the carriage, she has this long sort of philosophical monologue about the geological time that's passed in the area that they're about to enter, the age of Hanging Rock, and how it's been there for a million years. And she's speaking, and if you watch this performance, she's almost speaking as if in some sort of trance, as if she is speaking to some kind of special knowledge that she holds or that she has gained access to. And you get a sense from, I think it's Miriam that says the quote that you mentioned, like that little quote is like, oh, that you don't really get much about this character other than that quote. And it's just this sense of, oh, there's something a little off center about the way this character views the world and the people in it. And she is maybe not for this world in some way. And I think Miranda too is presented in a way that is, you know, very ethereal and angelic. But one of the things that Peter Weir talked about in the casting process upon finding her, when he was initially interviewing her along with some of the other girls that he was casting, he liked her, but he thought that she seemed a little too cosmopolitan, a little bit too worldly, like not quite someone who was the sort of naive innocent of the 1900s that he wanted. And then on a second meeting with her, he realized, no, actually what he wanted was someone who seemed like she was apart from all of those other girls in some way, that she had some secret wisdom or knowledge or worldliness behind her eyes that the others didn't share, but were drawn to. Everyone's so drawn to her, and she is this kind of otherworldly presence almost. And so you get the sense that the women who disappear and stay disappeared are all different some way. They're all out of step with society at the time, with the expectations that are held for women of that era. And so I think that the oddness of that line is crucial in giving you a sense of an understanding, even in that just one brief moment of, oh, she's different too. she, like, that's why she's up here too. Like, this is who Miriam is in this one line. And it's not something you would expect of a 15-year-old girl. It's very precocious and, you know, philosophical and of almost at a remove. Like, she's looking at these classmates as like some sort of, as if they're ants, as if they're insects, as if they're some other creature and not of her concern anymore.
We're starting to touch on my thematic reading of this, and I want to give a little bit of a history lesson for maybe those that are less familiar about Australian history. So this film is set in the year 1900. As a coincidence, the year that the book was released, 1967, is the year that we had a referendum in this country to recognize Aboriginal and Indigenous people as human beings, as opposed to flora and fauna. That's quite literally the wording. It's, you know, that was a nice time, 1967. I was like, yay, let's make that progress. But in 1900, I wonder how deliberate it is that the year 1901 is when Australia becomes Australia. On the 1st of January 1901, that's when the various colonies united to become the country of Australia. That's our federation. 1900 was like the last breaths of British full governmental control over the Australian colonies. So at this time of history, Victoria would have been its own entity within the Australian colonies, the British colonies of Australia, essentially. So I find it interesting that you're talking a lot about these out-of-step characters, these aliens, almost, these aliens that don't belong in their environment. And then you pull that reading back a little bit further and you go, well, what else are they? They're white, mostly upper class, British with British accents, in a harsh, natural environment where you have close-ups of cake, which doesn't belong in the bush, getting destroyed by ants, the nature of the area, the indigenous creatures of the area. You have these people wearing obscene, like February in Australia is hot.
It's hot as shit.
And these people,
yeah.
And these people are wearing like full gloves and suits and bringing little tables and cups for picnics. And it's just ridiculous. Like, it's just, no one does that stuff. But the Brits did in 1900, because guess what? They're not indigenous to the area. They're quite alien. Like my ancestors, I'm a white Australian man. My ancestors are colonizers, and we don't belong in this land. We're foreign to it. We're alien to it. And I do wonder a little bit about what the author might be trying to say about colonialization, you know, about these foreign actors that are trying to do British things and impose Britishness on this unwieldy, dangerous Australian landscape. And I wondered if that was something that maybe you picked up on as well.
I think it's absolutely one of the themes at heart, especially now knowing, which I didn't, that wasn't context that I had for knowing that this is taking place the year before Australia becomes a country. I have to believe that that was not a coincidence in the original novel either. I think that it very much feels like one of the themes that they're exploring. As you said, you get these visual touches of they're wearing these ridiculous outfits out in the middle of summer. Like, this is essentially what here in the States, it would be like August. Like, we're talking about the late summer. It's hot. It's muggy. It looks miserable out there. Like, I think in many of the close-up shots of our Australian leads, our Australian gentleman leads, there's like flies flying around their faces all the time. Like, it looks hot and sticky. And like, you see some of the local Australians dressed a little bit more practically. I'm sure that's not an accident. And when I say local Australians, I mean, like, you know, the locals, not the stuffy Brits, or the people who are trying to affect the posture and presentation and manners of the stuffy British. I mean, you have this English girls finishing school just plopped down in the middle of nowhere in South Australia. Like, you don't get the sense that it's surrounded by a town. Like, it just looks like it's dropped in the middle of the bush practically. And, you know, it was just this little piece of, you know, English colonial heritage that these people are clinging to, that I think it very much concerned Peter Weir when he was making this, concerned Joan Lindsay when she was writing the novel. I think too, it's a movie that is very much concerned with, like, what happens not just when you are, you know, a stranger in a strange land for which you are ill prepared, but what happens when you put all of these artificial restrictions on people in general, and women in particular, especially at this age and stage of development. You have all of this sexual and personal repression at work here. I mean, you know, talking about the ridiculous garb, like, there were all of these social mores dictating what you could wear in public and around whom. And, you know, the headmistress is introduced, you know, telling all these girls who are about to go for this summer picnic that, you know, once their carriage has left the site of town, then, because it's such a hot day, you can take your gloves off, but nothing else, nothing else. Now, of course, these girls being, you know, young women, and the fact that the headmistress isn't out there, of course they take off more than that. But, you know, the idea that the expectation would be you keep everything on, you can maybe take your gloves off as long as a man can't see you doing it. And that absolutely plays a role in what's going on under the surface here. We'll get into too. There's a, I don't know if this came up in your research, but there is a final chapter to the book, which was published posthumously, that does reveal a little bit more. It's still mysterious, but it reveals a little bit more about what ultimately happens to the girls. And, you know, I think I know what that red cloud was. And I think we know why, we learn why the one girl, Irma, who was found later, was found without her corset on. You know, that's not an accident. Like, these are, you know, these are girls who were filmed very early on in the movie, like, lacing up one another's corsets. The restrictions that are felt by these girls in this society are literalized through their clothing and through the etiquette lessons that are being forced on them by this school. So that's definitely something that Weir is playing with as well, as it's not just a story about people in a land with which they are unfamiliar, and, you know, that they're not prepared for or welcome to necessarily. And also, you know, the damage that we do to our children by forcing this rigidity on them and this repression on them.
Yes. And to take that reading a step further, because as I mentioned earlier, this is very much a film about the halfway point where what happens to the girls almost doesn't matter. Like, it's not trying to solve that mystery in any meaningful way. It's more about this headmistress and her, especially her relationship with Sarah, who is an orphan and poor. And she has this, like, benefactor that hasn't been paying the bills lately. And so therefore it becomes, okay, so why is this headmistress particularly going after Sarah, right? Like, is it because she's poor and the headmistress is rich and money hungry and money focused? And is that like a commentary about wealth versus poverty? Or is it about that control we're talking about? You know, like, no, you can't read a poem that you wrote. I don't care how good it is. It must be this poem. You must read this poem. You must pay your money on this day. You know, like, and all these little snipes that she takes at this girl. And yeah, it does sort of remind me, like, to think broadly about whether this film holds up. Thematically, it 1,000,000% does, because we're still doing it. You know, we like, you look at certain parts of the countries that you and I live in and around the world, there are the wealthy people that do okay for themselves, relatively speaking. And then there's like people that are just born into poverty, and these kids that are just treated different by the education system or just society at large. And a lot of them end up incarcerated or whatever. And then we sit there and say, oh, those damn mongrels, they're no good kids. But they never had a chance. And Sarah was an example of this no good kid that won't follow the rules. But, I mean, she never had a chance. She was an orphan. She had no money. She was separated from her brother. She was trying her best. She was a good kid. But she wasn't following the rules. So I found it was an interesting, yes, about control and about what we do to children, but also there's like a wealth dynamic there that I was picking up on. And the fact that poverty does subject you to a life of servitude, and you have to follow the rules or you're not useful and you're actually bad. And I don't know, it's such a rich text. There's so much in it.
There really is. And certainly, you know, yes, wealth disparity, but I think specifically given the culture that this is set in and where these people come from, class. I mean, class. Yes. As a whole, like, regardless of the actual money, like, the headmistress, she's not wealthy anymore. Like, she, like, that's part of why she's so desperate about the bills not being paid by the school. Like, if she was actually wealthy, she could afford to not care about whether money was coming in from anyone. Like, she's destitute. Like, the school is all she has left. And I'm not excusing her actions or her attitude, but that is the kind of desperate circumstance she finds herself in. But she can't let go of the class bullshit, all that English class bullshit. And I think that has more to do with her attitude towards Sarah than the actual money part of it. I think that she just views her as a lesser than, and not just lesser than the other girls, but, you know, lesser than herself, maybe even lesser than, you know, so the other, you know, there, I can't remember her name, but there's a maid servant who works at the school.
Minnie.
Yeah. Like, you know, like the servant class, like I, you get the sense that they, that she has a higher regard for them than she does for Sarah. Like it's an odd fixation that she has on this girl, and, you know, maybe there's something else too bubbling up under the surface with her, but I look at that interaction and I see a lot of class bullshit, and that being one of those central things that she is holding on to and carrying into this place. And not that the class bullshit belonged in British society where she was brought up, but it certainly isn't something you carry into this new land, you know, these old school values, if you can even call them that, they have even less place in this place.
Yeah. And it, again, that comes back to that hubris of colonialism, right? Like, we are the big dogs, and
this is the way things are done.
Yes, exactly.
It's simply the way things are done. It's,
this is,
it's
how we do it in Britain. This is how we do it in Australia. And it's like, well, guess what, right, champ? It doesn't work in Australia. Like, I looked ridiculous in the UK recently because it was, you know, autumn, I guess. And I was wearing, as you would call them, flip-flops quite a bit around London, and shorts while everyone was wearing jeans. But, like, that was just my way of life. I was doing the reverse of what the British did to my country. But if you come to Australia in the middle of summer and wear full-on suits and stuff, you're going to struggle. It's hard. You can't just do things exactly the same as Britain. You can probably wear relatively thick clothing in summer in the UK, and it's very different to here. It's very different. But that hubris of being like, no, this works. That's it.
Yeah. And it is interesting, too, that, you know, for as much as we're criticizing, you know, the headmistress, Mrs. Appleyard, you know, focusing on everybody follow the rules and, you know, do the do the thing that you're told, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, if they hadn't wandered off, they wouldn't have disappeared. I mean, I'm just saying, like, if they had just not done the thing they were told, like, they never would have gotten lost.
No, you're right. Always follow the rules. Always.
Yeah.
That's the message. That's a key message.
Key message. I think that's really the theme of the film, is that if you just do what you're told, respect authority at all times for all reasons, just nothing goes wrong.
Definitely, 100%. Let's talk about influence, because I like this one. When I was watching it, I got to tell you, all I could think about was the Virgin Suicides.
Yes, and that is definitely an influence that it had.
Yeah, I actually ended up reading that Sofia Coppola literally called this movie out and said, "Yep, Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette, thanks to Picnic Hanging Rock." And I'm like, that's interesting, because all I could think about was the Virgin Suicides when I was watching this thing. It's the same, not just obviously themes of, you know, girls not being around anymore and stuff like that, but it was this ethereal quality. Sometimes the way the sun shines on the characters, mm-hmm. like you could just tell it was the same DNA. But I also want to talk about the Australian New Wave. Because, and this is something that, ironically speaking, you are far more familiar with than I am. You've seen a few more Australian New Wave films than me. Now, this was not the very start of the Australian New Wave. I think we can credit that to some other films from the early 70s, films like Walkabout, even though it was directed by a Brit. We talked about that one a few years ago. Wake and Fright
is the, yeah, that's yeah. the big one.
That's the big one. It's sort of like our version of Deliverance, I guess, for those playing at home. And that one won a bunch of awards at the AFIs and went on to be a big deal. But I would say that Picnic at Hanging Rock was not the start of the Australian New Wave, but I think it really like kicked it up a notch.
Yeah, it became the signature entry in it, I think. I mean, you're right. Wake and Fright was properly kind of the start of it, if you want to pin like 1971 as like the start of the Australian New Wave. Mm. And it really was kind of a longish wave. It kind of, if you want to consider the end of it being like Mad Max, you know, at the end of the 70s, you know, you've got, you know, basically this 8-year period of the Australian New Wave. Mm. And yeah, I think that certainly... And I think this film had a little bit less of an impact in the States, at least initially. It has definitely since been reappraised and reappreciated. But the U.S. didn't do a great job of accepting a lot of these and embracing a lot of these Australian New Wave films. They wanted this to be redubbed in American or English accents. They did redub Mad really? Max when that got a limited release in the States. Yeah, like it's not Mel Gibson's voice in Mad Max.
Wow.
It, on like the VHS copy, that the first version I ever saw of Mad Max, it's dubbed over.
Wow.
Because the Australian accents were just too hard to decipher. It's ridiculous. And when you listen to it as intended, you're like, this
though.
Is perfectly... Nar.
We sound perfect, mate.
I think the international embrace of Picnic at Hanging Rock, though, was the thing that put it, it being the Australian New Wave and the Australian film industry, like properly on the map. I mean, this got attention in Europe for sure at the time. And, you know, it was a profitable movie. I mean, they made it for, I think, like $500,000 Australian. I think it made like $5 million and, you know, made more internationally and has made more since, you know, with home release and re-releases and stuff. So like, it's been a very successful movie for the industry itself, and it's been one of those, you know, kind of cultural touchstones for a lot of people, even for people who haven't seen a lot of Australian movies. Like a lot of people who, you know, if they've ever seen an Australian movie and it wasn't like Crocodile Dundee or a Mad Max movie, it was probably this one. Mm. I mean, generally speaking, if I had to guess, especially if you're at all sort of in the market for international art house films in the 70s, you kind of have to go through Picnic at Hanging Rock if you're at all interested in taking that that era of film seriously. And I think people still come to this movie and find things to admire about it. Like I don't know, aside from Virgin Suicides, who I could point to or what I could point to as a specific point of influence, but you know, this is regularly referenced too in queer cinema, in horror cinema. Like as non-bloody or graphic as it is an unsettling mood piece. It really does a good job of evoking, you know, atmosphere. He's using a lot of weird, he's using a lot of different techniques to create a sense of unease in the audience. Like there are, for example, periods where he will keep the camera on an actor's face and have them not blink, and he'll lower the frame rate. He'll do it in slow motion, and it you can't quite put your finger on what's weird about the scene, but it's because it's slow motion, and you're just not really picking up that it's slow motion. And so he's employing all of these techniques to create these feelings in the audience. And that is something that I think a lot of filmmakers have probably studied. The gauze that the cinematographer Russell Boyd stretched across the lens to get that diffuse soft focus that he uses so well. I mean, like things like that, those sort of DIY indie film techniques that they used on this film, I'm sure that stuff has had influence on others.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about that diffusing of the lens of the image, because talking about what makes this film great, Russell Boyd's photography, good stuff. You know, this is like lights out, looks amazing. I've got Film Grab up in front of me. There's some shots that are just, they're like really, really, and like beautifully composed. I'll talk about one of my favorite shots. It was very early on, and it's when I locked in proper, because you know the first few things that you see, like you see that the rock essentially, and then you start seeing like, oh, it's like the girls getting ready, and you can see some like wide shots of the school that they're at and things like that. It's all pretty mundane, ethereal, kind of looks nice-ish. It's a period piece. I'm kind of like you. I have this like discrimination against period pieces for some reason. Then it has the shot for me. The shot. And it's Miranda getting ready in front of like her little dresser with mirrors, plural. And you got Sarah in the background, and you're looking at the mirrors. So you can see Miranda on the left. You can see Miranda reflected in a smaller mirror on the right. And in the middle of those two reflections is a reflection of Sarah with her back to us on the bed in the background. And just the composition, just the way that that's been put together, it could be just like a little throwaway line or whatever else. A throwaway shot, whatever. It's just, it's interesting. It's got visual language, and you can read into it. You can be like, look, Sarah is in this shot, and she is surrounded on all sides by Miranda. Like, she's obsessed with Miranda. She loves Miranda. Like, there's visual language there as well. But apart from that, it's just a cool shot, you know, and this film is filled with cool shots. And the way that these oddly dressed humans are set against this backdrop of nature, it looks very like juxtaposed almost, you know, and it looks odd, it looks out of place. And again, that photography, I mean, Russell Boyd is just, killing it. I think he does a fantastic job.
Yeah, and he said he was inspired visually by Australian impressionist painters. So he looked at paintings that were being produced around 1900, late 1800s, and took that soft, diffuse back lighting as his big visual inspiration for so much of the look of the film. And you know, you get a few of those shots when they're all in repose at Hanging Rock and kind of dozing in the midday light. And you know, he was like, we're going to have this perfect light for 1 hour every day. And we're going to just, you know, 8 days in a row, we're just going to shoot for this 1 hour and get this light exactly right for some of these shots. And it pays off. I mean, it you have, you know, again, this is another one of those movies that you just pluck a frame out and put it on a wall. There's so many shots like that. Russell Boyd deserves a lot of credit for how well this movie works and how well it's remembered.
I shouted out earlier as well, Bruce Smeaton, who does the composing for the film. It uses some Beethoven in there, and it uses the pan flute played by George Zamfir. And I adore it. I adore the score as well. I don't know if this is because I've been reading The Sound of Cinema by Sean Wilson, famed author, friend of the show, but my appreciation for film scores has gone through the roof in the last few years, and I really noticed it in this movie. It's at times it kind of almost feels maybe overpowering, particularly during the ascent up the rock, but also I feel like kind of adds to this this weird feeling we're supposed to have. Like, you know, film music shouldn't normally sound like this. This doesn't sound like an orchestral kind of sound. This is a pan flute. This is odd. This is different. This is weird. It feels foreign almost again, because it's played by a European pan flute artist. You know, it feels out of place or something. And there's this weird disconnect that's happening that I think is entirely deliberate and very, very effective. What are your thoughts on the score?
I think the score and the soundscape of the movie is such an important, I mean, I know I just said this about the cinematography, but it is such an important part of why this film works. It all works in conjunction, but the oral landscape that's created to match the physical landscape of Hanging Rock is really effective, really unsettling in the moments where it wants to be. I found the choral notes, the electronic music that was used, the pan flute, like all of these decisions all create these different really evocative moodscapes where you're feeling deeply unsettled one moment and then you're just sort of like basking in the lyrical beauty of it all in the next. And it doesn't feel like a wild tonal shift. Like there's a couple of moments that are a little bit more aggressive when a couple of big things happen. Even though there are these shifts in tone, none of it feels jarring. All of it feels organic. And, you know, some of these sounds that are generated like do sound as if they are coming from the earth itself, coming from the environment itself, as if the mountain is actually speaking through this this soundscape.
Yeah. Totally agree. Let's talk about Peter Weir. Strap yourself in. It's that time again for a wildly hyperbolic take.
Let's get weird.
Peter Weir is Australia's greatest director. Thoughts?
He's in the conversation. I have not watched all of Peter Weir's films. I love the ones that I have seen. Generally speaking, I don't think I've seen one that I haven't at least really, really liked. I love Master and Commander. I really, really liked The Truman Show. Dead Poets Society, I haven't watched in ages, but I mean, that was a big one growing up. Witness is great. I haven't seen a few of his other movies, but bigger movies, but I really want to see The Last Wave, his follow-up to this one, another sort of Australian new wave high point. And I really like the guy's work. I think he's so consistently fantastic, at least of the work that I've seen.
Couldn't agree more. I think the reason that this take holds some water is the fact that across four different decades, he's delivered at least one movie that is like, wow, that's like shooting the lights out stuff, right? So like people think Hanging Rock in the 70s. In the 80s, you'd probably point to Dead Poets Society as his...
Or Witness. Lights.
Witness is a great movie, but like I'd probably go to Dead Poets, but yeah, they're great sure. movies. 90s Truman Show, like far yeah. out. And then 2000s. Now, I haven't seen Master and Commander, which is a big blind spot for me, but you called it your favorite film of 2003, if memory serves.
It's definitely one of them. It fucking rocks. I got to see that on the big screen again this year, the latest, you know, 4K remaster of it, and it rules.
Also shot by Russell Boyd, an Oscar-winning cinematography performance from him. And yeah, that alone, I think, puts him in that category. Other candidates for greatest Australian director are people like George Miller, who also, across decades, I think Fury Road might be Australia's best movie.
Yeah, I mean, the guy gets credit for making seminal action movies in three of the last four decades.
Yeah. I struggle to think of another Australian film. I mean, in recent times, Jennifer Kent has put her hand up with The Babadook and The Nightingale, which are both fantastic.
You're a big Baz Luhrmann guy.
No, I'm not. I'm not. So do not, like, that's slant, that's libel.
Put that evil on me.
Strictly Ballroom's a great Australian movie, and that was one of his, maybe his earliest movie, one of his earlier movies. I haven't liked his output since, really, but, you know, and other people have made great movies. You know, I think of Stephen Elliott made The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, but he hasn't really kicked on the same way others did. I think of Rolf De Heer, who made 10 Canoes, but again, didn't really kick on. You know, I think it's like George Miller and Peter Weir in a shootout. And I think Peter Weir might take it, because George Miller has maybe is penalized for less variety in his very, very best films.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I admittedly have not seen as many of George Miller's non-Mad Max films to properly evaluate, and I have also seen far too few of Peter Weir's to fully evaluate his body of work. Like, he might have some real stinkers that I just haven't seen. I just know that of the ones that I have seen, like, we're talking about stone cold classics as far as I'm concerned. So yeah. I do think that there's something to the argument. It is certainly an argument to be made. I do not think this is a scorching hot take. I think this is a perfectly reasonable room temperature take, but it is an interesting question though. Like who would get that crown? I really wish that he hadn't been, you know, he's more or less confirmed it. But, you know, really wish that I had known that he was going to just not make another movie after, you know, the last one that came out 15 years ago. He just kind
of way back, yeah.
quietly retired.
Yeah. And, but, you know, I've been nominated for 6 Oscars across his career and, you know, Australian film, I say Australian legend a lot on this show, but quite genuinely, Peter Weir, Australian legend. Let's talk about any shortcomings we might have with the film. I mentioned a bit of a disconnect with some of the performances, and I think particularly Edith's character, who I can only imagine how bad the voice acting was live, because the voice acting on the dub by a different actor, played by Barbara Llewellyn, is equally bad. It's like, oh, they're going up the hill with no shoes, you know, no, sorry, that's just like really bad stuff. So I guess some of the performances by some of the voice actors or cast members or both kind of put me off a little bit. Do you have any shortcomings about the film?
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. Edith didn't rub me quite as poorly this time around. I mean, I think that just the character itself is a little bit grating, which doesn't,
yes,
it doesn't help, you know.
Yeah,
it's
that's true.
Unfortunately, it's just how she's written. I mean, you know, like it's not as bad when they're first going up, but when like the girls have already disappeared and she's going up there and she's complaining, it's like, your friends could be dead. Like, why are you complaining about the heat now? Like, it's one thing when you guys were just wandering off having fun, but like, you're trying to find your friends before they die. Like, stop complaining so much. Jesus Christ.
I'm tired like I am now. It's like, shut up.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I did like kind of want to like have one of the characters be like, stop it. Stop it. Just stop it. Oh, and then like when all the girls are so nasty to Irma when she comes to say goodbye, like she's like leading the charge against her. And it's like, you were up there too, man. You were up there too, and you're just as unhelpful. You had just as few answers as Irma, and now you're shrieking in her face about what happened. You know what happened. Like, shut up. Shut up, Edith.
All the while, Sarah is like tied to a wall.
Oh my God, right?
Like,
yeah.
But it's like, what is going on? I found that scene with Irma being just basically mauled verbally by her friends. I found that so surprising, actually. Like, it was like, oh, geez, I expected, like Irma did, like, a warm welcome. And then it was just, like, screeching and yelling and, tell us what happened up on that hill! You know, like, oh, God, like, yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. That was an interesting scene. Okay, so we agree on the shortcomings. It's basically like some of the performances just aren't quite pitch perfect.
Some of the performances, there's like a little bit of a, and I haven't read the book. It's just sitting on my ever-growing to get to someday pile. But I don't know exactly how it's handled in the beginning. But the dialogue between Miranda and Sarah very early on, there was a shift from one line to the next that Miranda has that I thought was just a little abrupt where yeah. She goes, you'll have to, you know, she's saying to Sarah, like, one of these days you'll have to come home with me to meet my funny family. And she's being like wistful and thinking about like happy times, presumably with said family. And then the very next line she has, I mean, there's like a gap of time in there where, you know, her face kind of changes. She has a thought. And then she says to Sarah, you're going to have to like
find someone else
to love because yeah. I'm not going to be around for much longer. And it's like this sense of, well, did you just invite her home. Like, didn't you just say you'll have to come home with me one of these days? And the very next sentence out of your mouth is you're going to have to get over me because I'm about to leave.
And there's no edit. There's no cut. It's like 5 seconds.
There's nothing. It's the same scene. It's the same moment. And that beat to me is one that like it still kind of sticks in my craw. It's like I'm not exactly sure where it's confusing in a way that some of the other confusing or nonsensical or less sensical stuff that comes out of some of their mouths, like I can explain that away as just sort of part of the surreal nature of what's happening, whatever's happening to these characters, or whatever influence the Hanging Rock is having on them, you know, the stuff that's happening on the rock, I can much sort of more easily explain in that way. But when she says that to Sarah in the beginning, I'm like, I get it. If you're telling her you're not going to be around for much longer, we can sort of think about what you meant by that after the fact. But
yeah.
The invitation is the part that's incongruous to me. And I it's almost as if she's again, like I felt like with the teacher when she was going on her monologue in the carriage, it's almost like she's entering like a little bit of a trance state where she's sort of shifting into some other state of being or thinking or perceiving, and we just are that's the incongruity there. But it does bump me a little bit that moment. There's a couple of performance moments, dialogue deliveries here and there that are just a little iffy. I think some of that comes down to a lot of these actors were inexperienced or just less experience, certainly when it comes to being on camera and in film. And, you know, I don't know how many takes some of these actors were allowed to get, given that this was a pretty budget shoot, and that sometimes in certain scenes they only had a couple of hours to work with in terms of light. Like, they're just, there may have been some takes that they just had to kind of shrug and say, all right, well, that's the best one we got.
Yeah, maybe. Because it's hard to, with a film that looks this good and some of those shots that we talked about, the composition and the detail they've gone into, it's very hard to believe that the director just went, oh, well, we don't care about the performances that much. You know,
but like, if you, oh, for sure. But sometimes you just sort of shoot and you hope you get what you have. And we have time for two more setups and this, and then we have what we have.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that. Let's talk briefly. I've already mentioned my two favorite behind the scenes facts. You know, you mentioned the, placing a bridal veil essentially over the lens to get that look, especially during the hanging rock scenes. I found that fascinating. It reminds me very much of when they used to put petroleum jelly on the lens to get the shine, you know, in those old Hollywood movies. That sort of technique is really interesting to me. And also that the schoolgirls were dubbed, a bunch of them were dubbed by professional voice actors. So that was right. My two behind the scenes ones. We've already kind of mentioned them. Do you have anything else that tickles your fancy from behind the scenes?
So the set of the school, that house that they found in South Australia, mm-hmm. was originally built by a fellow who was trying to win the affection of this woman that he had fallen in love with back in the UK. And he was trying to get her to move to Australia to be with him. And she told him that she couldn't possibly move to Australia unless he built an exact replica of her home that she grew up in back in the UK. And he did exactly that. And that is what the building is that they shot as the setting for the school. And wouldn't you know it, after he built the fucking thing, she still had no interest in moving to Australia. And he eventually lost the property in a gambling scenario.
Wow.
So, yeah, he gambled away the house after the woman he built it for still didn't want to come to Australia for him.
There's a lot of incel behavior on the internet, and there's a lot of men talking about like being rejected by women and da 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 da. That one's a particularly heartbreaking rejection. That one, like
that'll radicalize a fucker.
Yeah,
radicalize someone. Probably for the best. He didn't live much longer. he would have become a bad person.
Because
he would have become someone you did not want to socialize with.
No, because, I mean, you know, assuming that that's true, and it probably isn't, you know, because, like, let's just say there's been plenty of men in history that are like, yeah, she said if I built her a house that she'd come, and then she didn't, the bitch. But it's like, well, did she say that, or are you just making that up?
Right.
Are you just justifying this crazy move?
Yeah, like, were you just not picking up the hint by, like, her asking for something she thought had zero chance of actually happening? Like, that was her way of saying no, and you just couldn't take a hint.
Yeah. Like, come on, man. Are you struggling that much with social cues? I don't know. That's a great yarn, though, a great story. I don't know if the word yarn translates. Great yarn, great story.
Yeah, we have that here in the US.
Okay, cool. I never know with some of these translations that we have.
That's fair.
What's the best scene of the movie, do you think?
Ooh, best scene. So,
There's some good ones.
I think the initial disappearance is a really strong contender for me. That mm-hmm. whole sequence, the way it builds, the sound, the atmosphere that they're able to create, it's very otherworldly and unsettling and tense, and finally kind of scary. Like, when I'll give Edith or whoever did the scream credit, like, that scream is piercing, and it, like, it's pretty upsetting. It's a pretty blood curdling scream, and it happens at this moment of great strangeness. And that part as a whole is possibly my favorite sequence, I'll say. And I guess, you know, I really like the moment at the end when Albert is realizing, when we, the audience, realize that Albert and Bertie are one and the same, and that he was Sarah's brother the whole time. And I just find that sequence like
heartbreaking,
just really.
Yeah.
Like when he's talking to Michael at the end about it, it gets me every time. And I think those are like that first sequence where they're all wandering up and eventually disappear is so effective. And then I'm really affected by that reveal of Albert's at the end.
Albert, by the way, Australian legend John Jarrett. Are you familiar with Wolf Creek?
I've heard of Wolf Creek, yeah.
Well, he's like the main like killer in Wolf Creek. Mm. And so it was a very disconcerting thing for an Australian kid. So I'm recognizing him as an adult, being like, oh, that's John Jarrett. Wow, he looks really young there. Because I've always known John Jarrett as having gray hair. He was married to a woman named Noni Hazelhurst over here in Australia, who was on children's TV shows. She was on Play School, you know, and then they co-hosted, amongst with other co-hosts, a show called Better Homes and Gardens, which was basically like, here's how to do gardening in your house. Like, so John Jarrett, husband of Noni Hazelhurst, co-host of Better Homes and Gardens, was a serial killer in Wolf Creek, and it was such a big, like, switch, you know? Like, the whole Australian media over here was like, whoa, John Jarrett, like, you've never seen him before. And I appreciated seeing him, you know, 30 years prior to Wolf Creek, being like, oh, like, this is, like, a nice little role.
Yeah, I think he gives a good performance. I think he's, of the two male leads, he's certainly, I think, the stronger performance for me.
Yeah, agreed. I
bounce a little bit off of our English fellow as much Michael, as I appreciate his earnestness. Like, I just, something about that character, that performance just doesn't always work for me. It's a little, I realize that he's trying to play a very sort of like stuffy, affected Brit, and, you know, his gradual loosening up is part of his story. But something about that character, that performance, just never quite goes to that next level that I want it to for me. But I thought John Jarrett was good.
I agree. I think maybe Michael was a victim as a character of the edit of the film. So in the book, Irma, after she is found, is recovering at Michael's house. And that's the same in the movie. But in the book, there's like a romance that builds between the two.
Yeah. And there was in the theatrical version of Picnic as well. And it got changed back in 98. But Weir always maintains that his original, because there are people who miss that romance arc for him that's in the movie that they really liked and that is from the book. But he had elected to take it out before the film originally premiered, but he was not given the budget or the permission or both to open it back up for that one last edit. But he claims it is one he's always intended, that sequence was never intended to actually make it to that theatrical cut, but that he didn't have the ability to change it until many years later. I have seen those sequences in isolation. I have not seen the theatrical version in its entirety, so I don't really know exactly how it plays out. It's fine. It's a fairly short section. I mean, I think it's only like 7 or 8 total minutes of the movie that got excised. It wasn't a really long section. And I think for me, and maybe they changed the emphasis on this by editing other things subtly, but for me, I would find the the sudden shift in focus for him from Miranda, who he's clearly been kind of infatuated with from the very beginning, shifting from her to Irma felt a little bit like, you know, displaced affection, or a little bit like he was just sort of, re-targeting his affections. You know, Miranda disappeared, but the closest thing he can get is Irma. And I don't know, it didn't really work for me either. But again, I've only watched those scenes in isolation. I haven't seen them as part of the whole. So maybe I would feel a little bit differently if I was able to appreciate the full impact. But his character is just a little bit on the dull side for me.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think just to close that one up, in the book, there's like an implied romance arc, but Irma is more interested than Michael, and Michael's family is more interested than Michael because of Irma's wealth. Okay. So the whole thing about Michael remembering and envisioning Miranda and envisioning the white swan and all of that is meant to suggest that despite, you know, being told and having this very pretty girl who's very rich and very interested, he's still enamored with this other love. And I think that's right. Maybe more interesting. We still see some remnants of that with him having visions of Miranda. And I'll never forget her. Like, that's the dream that he keeps talking about with Albert before Albert talks about his sister. So I think that's interesting, but I do agree that on a whole, he's probably one of the more dull characters for sure, and maybe was treated very differently in the book. But that's what's going to happen with adaptation. I think otherwise the adaptation works well, especially the edit that we saw. It's lean. It gets in and out. It's got this central mystery. It's got some great scenes. I agree with you that the pick of the scenes is definitely the initial disappearance. Like the way that the sound design builds and everything is remarkable. You know, it's shot beautifully. It's composed beautifully by Peter Weir as director. Some of the performances are really good. I think Miranda, played by Anne Lambert, is ethereal, and that's a big part of it. So picking an MVP, Ian, it's going to be hard.
It's going to be hard. I think for me, the kind of co-MVPs are going to be kind of Weir and Boyd. I think that I'd give the slight edge to the two of them, even though I think the soundscape that's created is incredibly important to the mood and atmosphere. But I think visualizing all of this and also figuring out the way to adapt, because it's not just adapting the dialogue, you know, it's also Weir very consciously wanted to evoke the feeling of mystery and of there being these unsettling details under the surface that were suggestive of something more at play, which it turns out the author like did have in mind. Like, she had something a little otherworldly, fantastical in mind for what was going on here, even if she didn't spell it out explicitly. And I think he does a really good job of adapting that as well, because that could have been something that was harder to translate because it's not as clear on the page as a description of a scene or as a snippet of dialogue. It's like, you know, how do you adapt the feeling that a book gives you as you read it? And I think he did a good job of translating that experience into an analogous experience with this film.
I have two names. They're not the same two names. Obviously, Peter Weir is, as I said before, he's probably Australia's greatest director. Russell Boyd is a great shout. He's one of the names that I had because some of the favorite things about the film are the shots. So I think he gets a lot of credit. But the other name I had, and who I'll now call out, is Joan Lindsay, the original author. And I think the adherent, like, this is the way this story is composed. We talked at length about the themes of the film and how rich the text is to have all of that in there. And I think on reflection, the more I think about this movie, the more I, even in conversation with you, I feel like I've unpacked a little bit more as well. I really admire all of the work that she's doing, perhaps accidentally at some occasions. But again, like, I think the year 1900 is deliberate, you know, like, I think there's a lot of thematic resonance there that is so rich. And I just have to give credit to it. And I have to give credit to her for her adherence to the mystery. Apart from that posthumous chapter that was edited out, there was this whole thing, and you might have seen the interview on one of the DVD extras, Peter Weir talking about going to meet her, because the weird thing about this was that she had to approve the director, which was an unusual experience for directors. So he's going for this audition, basically, to have lunch with Joan Lindsay and talking about their vision for how it goes and everything. And there was one question he wasn't allowed to ask, which is, what happens to the girls? And so he asked it anyway. And she says, young man, do not ever ask that question ever again. And he didn't. But I just love this, like, this secrecy around it. And I think the mystery is a big part of the success of this film. Like, it probably turns some audiences off because they want the nice little bow on the story. But this one refuses to give it. And, you know, credit to Peter Weir for his adherence to that as well. But certainly, I think a lot of credit goes to Joan Lindsay. So I think I'll go with her for my MVP. And with of course, a shout out to Russell.
Yeah. And the initial very clever conceit of hers, which they decided successfully to continue with the movie, is to present it as this factual thing that happens way yes. back then. And it's very much a kind of a Fargo thing. Like, it presents up front as being a thing that actually happened, and they don't disabuse you of that impression at any point, despite the fact that there's no evidence that this thing actually happened. And mm-hmm. so I think preserving the atmosphere of mystery without preserving the trappings of a mystery movie was one of Weir's really intelligent decisions, because I think if he had kept it as a mystery, like, he would have had to provide some solution. He would have had to invent a solution, and there isn't one. It's an unsolved fake mystery, right? Yeah. It's all made up. There's no real solution here. So in theory, he could have come up with anything he wanted. And instead, what he did was, instead of creating a mystery to solve, he created an experience to have. And it's something that asks, I think, deeper questions about the greater mysteries of life, but it is not about what happened to these four people.
Exactly. And I mean, and you know, yes, there's like all these little clues, you know, like the watches stop at exactly midday, and the girls fall into a trance and take their shoes off and head up the rock, and there's a Sarah is found dead in a garden of pansies, and did she commit suicide, or was she killed by Mrs. Appleyard? And you can make readings into these things, and it encourages you to make readings into these things, because you need answers. We're humans, we need answers. So we're trying to find the answer. Is it aliens? Is it this? Did she murder her? Is it, like, whatever. Did the teacher go up and sexually assault them? Like, well, I don't know what happened. But in searching for meaning, we end up finding meaning, and that meaning is in the themes, you know, the colonialism, the class difference, the control over these women, the repression. And I just think it's just so, yeah, it's quite brilliant. The more I think about it, the more it bumps up my rating of the film, actually. I think it's quite special. Thank you for making it a non-negotiable.
I really wanted to get it in. It felt like, if we're not going to get it in now, when? Because, I mean, I might draft it in the movie draft. We don't know. But, like, this is one of those movies that when I saw it, and knowing that you're an Aussie, I was like, we got to cover this at some point. We got to get weird.
We got weird. So thank you so much for coming up with that. As you mentioned, we're coming towards the end of the year. We had to squeeze it in. We have, we're a bit all over the shop with where movies are landing, but we definitely do have a Christmas special coming up with Charlie Brown's Christmas. And we do have the draft that you mentioned where you, me, Andy Williams and Violet Hammond will be squaring off to draft the films from years that end in five. And yes, this one is a candidate. This is certainly going to be a candidate for me. It'll be a candidate for you. And maybe we're going to have to fight for it in 1975. Who knows?
There's a couple of movies we're going to have to fight for this draft. I already know.
Yeah, there's some years that are leaner than others. So I think there's going to be a few of us just like really iron off, like, you know, I'm not going to mention them as trying to keep my strategy to myself, but there are some years that are a little bit leaner than others. We've got to lock in those really classic ones. Yeah.
Yep.
I think we know. Ian, thank you so much, of course, for suggesting this and for joining me. You're so busy in the podcast world. So what I'll do is I will recommend that people, if they love Star Trek, if they love Severance, if they love physical media, like collecting DVDs and Blu-rays, that you have shows about all those things, and we can find a link to each of those shows in the show notes. I'll make sure that I put them in there. So no need to advertise per se. You are a very busy man. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you. This is always fun.
And thank you to the audience as well. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe to Movieversaries. And if your podcast app allows it, give us a rating and a review. It really helps us get out there. And as I said, while you're here, please check out the show notes where you'll find links to Ian's other shows and also my link tree where you can find my other shows as well. You'll also find a link to the Discord in there where you can come and have a chat with us as well. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.